Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black. And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
When your business value is wrapped up in your client list, what's the most important thing you can do to drive the value of your business? We asked expert Stacy McKibben.
If you don't have really strong, you know, client relation management tools, CRMs as they're lovingly referred to, if you don't have tools like that in your business, it's going to be very difficult to transition it over. As a matter of fact, your next buyer is going to use that as a reason to drive down your sale price. Absolutely, one of the biggest areas of opportunity that we see in professional services businesses are going back to your existing and previous clients. Oftentimes we just forget that they don't necessarily know the full breadth of services that we provide and how they can use us or even refer us to their friends and family. So that is a big win in most businesses, is just starting there. And it's very difficult to do if you don't have a good system in place with which to do it.
One of the most common ways a business is sold is through something called an earnout. And we asked for information and an example from business broker Chris Bond.
What buyers want to have happen is they want a seller to prove the actual value of the business by having them be patient and waiting for a piece of the payout. So in other words, once the transition period has happened, say 6, 12, 18, or 24 months, the buyer will make additional payments with the comfort that, okay, it is what you said it is. Had a very creative deal earlier this year where down payment was made for about 80% of the deal. A bank stepped in for a percentage of the deal. The seller actually financed another small percentage of the deal. And the earnout comes in years 3, 4, and 5. So everybody's pulling in the same direction, making sure the first 2 years go very smoothly.
What are some of the challenges for leaders in this knowledge-based economy? Here's CEO Coach Bill Anton.
The person that has the most influence over the entire organization is the person that leads the organization. And transforming that person exponentially influences change. My training as a psychologist, my understanding about the kinds of organizations that are going to be successful in the future are going to be organizations that realize that knowledge is their product and that knowledge can only be created by enrollment, not by compliance. And so the task of the leader of the future is to transform the people that work in the organization so that they want to give their best and so that they're willing to offer ideas and perspectives that create knowledge and innovation for the organization.
Medical insurance is a big part of your budget. How do you contain those costs? We ask benefits expert Rhett Bray.
We'll talk about wellness is how we can start to communicate the importance of the wellness and that we give the people and the employees the opportunities to do things that will help them to become healthier. We start to educate them on the importance of annual physicals. We start to educate them on preventative care. Women do this quite well. Men have a tendency to wait till body parts don't work and then they go, which can be late. And it's interesting, we take better care of our car. We change the oil. We see the lamp light comes on, and for a lot of us, we don't do the maintenance that we should do on a regular basis. That will identify a lot of issues that people have that now you can start to address either through medication, through exercise or diet. There are just a few key areas that you can identify that will drive these higher costs.
Okay, so we've heard the term before, treat your business like an investment. It'll be a lot easier to sell down the road. What exactly does that mean? We asked an expert, Don Berzin.
Many of us in the field encourage owners to look at their business as an investment. Some owners understand that concept, but many do not. I mean, for a number of them, they see their business as either a job, a cash machine, a passion, or an extension of who they are. And the term investment sounds a little too removed for them to relate to. And we also let it be known that a business is actually easier to sell when it has a passive ownership. I mean, an owner who is not personally critical to maintaining future cash flows. But let's face it, I mean, one of the last terms that ever come to mind when we think about most entrepreneurs is passive. You know, these people are doers. They make things happen. And sitting on the sidelines is not something that many of them want to do at any stage of their career.
At ExitCoachRadio.com, we're interviewing over 100 top advisors to get you one-minute tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new content daily at 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Why would you have a revocable living trust instead of a will? Here's attorney Matt Amaro.
One of the main reasons that you would consider doing a revocable trust versus just having a will is avoiding what we would call a probate process, which is a court proceeding to distribute a family estate, which can be very expensive and legal fees, court fees, and just involves a lot of court involvement that can be pretty painful. So by using a trust, you can get out of that. Now, if your assets aren't high enough, that's one way you may be able to avoid probate without a trust. And the other way is you may have assets that are able to pass to beneficiaries outside of a trust and outside of probate, even if you don't have a trust. But when you have real property, you usually won't be able to avail yourself of those two exceptions to staying out of probate.
How do most people decide it's time to start exit planning, and what's on their mind when they do? Here's Jim Immel.
Long term is really interesting. I use the analogy of the light switch. Sometimes these business owners don't think about it, and then all of a sudden they wake up one day and they just want to turn the light switch off, and they go from being passionate 100% into the game, and then all of a sudden something starts feeling heavy. Maybe it's a personal situation that's happened, but they literally turn the light switch off. Most of the people that you and I work with, it's more like a dimmer switch. They just don't do it that quick. They do it over time. But what really a lot of them are thinking about is, how do I transition myself out of the leadership position, provide other people opportunity to get into that leadership position so the business is being prepared to transition from a position of strength and not weakness.
People are nervous about stocks and bonds these days. What's the outlook for income real estate? We asked real estate expert Scott Tamkin.
I'm a firm believer that income property will grow wealth over time. And there are parts of Los Angeles where income property is still affordable. The west side of LA doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but there are parts of LA where there are still opportunities. And I firmly believe that, particularly in some of the outlying areas, the gentrification will continue and people will want to rent in those areas, particularly as public transportation expands. People have some extra money. They're looking to invest in income property. I would say good strategy might be to join up with others who are doing the same. There are some crowdfunding sites that offer some opportunities to do that, but I would be careful just jumping in and talk to an expert in the multifamily business. I think over time it will prove to be lucrative.
Protecting your assets is important, but when you do it is even more important. Here's attorney Harry Barth.
A very important component to understand is that, as with all business deals, asset protection being just one of them, is to be able to settle a proposed claim within reasonable limits. It's very, very difficult to do that if you're in jeopardy of losing your home, losing your business, and losing your life savings. So I think that it's important that asset protection is granular. We look at the various components, we take into consideration all of the goals and objectives of our particular clients. And there's not one size fits all. Every situation is different, every background is different, every family makeup is different, every business transaction is different.
What's the best way to use Twitter and other social media? We asked expert Tim Templeton.
I just had a friend ask me today, I don't really get Twitter. What is the value? And I said, you know, it's two things. It's self-promotion, or business promotion in this case, and it's research. So if you want people to know who you are and what you're doing, and you create content, you create blog content, you want people to see it, one of the best ways to get it out in front of people is to send out an announcement using Twitter. Likewise, if you're trying to find people in your ecosystem, your business, the analysts, the resellers, the potential partners, you can find them by their activity on Twitter. You can interact with them, you can follow them, you can retweet things that they're sending, and you can create a relationship that way, which is a lot easier than it used to be.
And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
What are some of the factors that go into evaluating a business at any given time? We asked valuation expert Christopher Mercer.
It's one thing to say that your value is worth what a willing buyer and a willing seller will pay, but that same willing buyer and same willing seller won't pay the same thing in 2008 as they will in 2014, because in 2008 the world was full of uncertainty that caused financing to dry up, and it was enormously difficult to sell. Some of your listeners that are listening to this need to think about the fact that they need to be thinking of an orderly transition of management and ownership, because when bad things happen to your company, you lose all flexibility in terms of ownership and management transition. So take care of those things now while you can.
Being in business is inherently risky. We all know that. But what are some of the most common mistakes that business owners make and their potential solutions? We asked for comments from attorney Mayar Ghassemian.
One of the important mistakes is not having a corporation or LLC or another form of entity that would limit their liability in case they get sued. I have seen a lot of companies that do this, and it's very prevalent in the construction industry. If they are around for a while and they don't have an entity, they are going to be sued sometimes, especially in construction. And what happens is, and they put their own personal properties in danger because they don't have an entity that would protect them.
What are some of the important factors that go into a professional business valuation? We asked expert Roger Winsby.
Valuation is really about a sense of future opportunities offset by the risks. And if you don't really think those through as it relates to each individual company, you won't really understand whether you might be above average on that multiple or below average, but it's going to be quite rare when you're right on the average or the median. It's quite an issue that comes up in terms of understanding, you know, the business and being able to document your findings. Valuation is really about future, and as much as, you know, people want to say, well, you know, here are my retained earnings and here's what I've done, and that's, you know, very important context, but ultimately if someone wants to buy the business, they're buying the future opportunity and weighing that against the future risks.
You know, a lot of business owners I talk to have an image in their mind of how they're going to put up a for sale sign and sell their business quickly and easily, get a big check and invest it. Here's a message from someone who's done it, Veronica Saldivar.
A lot of folks just think, I'm going to sell for X amount of dollars. And, you know, especially here for us in California and other similar states, taxes are a huge, huge consideration. It takes a big bite at your bottom line. I think also one of the other things is to consult with a CPA on that tax liability. When I was negotiating the sale of my business and negotiating the purchase and sale agreement, I also met several times with a tax attorney as well. He helped me draft the documents to prepare to make sure that I was going to fall under cap gains tax treatment, which was huge.
When you're undertaking a big project like exit planning, it's important to know that your advisors are using a specific process. Here's Leo Klein.
Our approach is to say, well, let's have initially that conversation. Let's do some initial fact finding on everything that is in, you know, that it needs to be looked at to develop that strategy. And once we sort of have developed the strategy, what we do is present that strategy in sort of in a team meeting to all the other advisors, and if needed, we bring in some new advisors if there are certain gaps. Here's the strategy, here are the facts. Let's discuss this and provide your input and suggestions. Let's refine the strategy based on your expertise and then let's finalize it and then implement it. And then from my perspective, best practice is that sort of you repeat this process once a year until you conduct your exit.
At ExitCoachRadio.com, we're interviewing over 100 top advisors to get you one-minute tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new content daily at 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
If you're going to grow your business, you've got to grow your sales. Here's Brad Leggett.
One of the key things we work with is performance management. How do you set targets? How do you get a sales team to perform? Because in about roughly half the companies we go into, there aren't formal sales targets in place. And that can be very demotivational to a sales team because they don't know where they're expected to perform to. You often have a very frustrated CEO or head of sales that says, well, the team's not doing well, but they haven't articulated what that target is. And our approach is you work with the sales team to set targets. I mean, the first piece of advice I've got is get a sales target that's written down and put it in front of everybody. That's step one.
Okay.
At least have that. But it's much better to set targets with the sales team's involvement. So sit down, and you don't want to walk into this meeting with a salesperson without some idea of the sales target. You'll have an idea of where it should be. Let's talk about where we think we can get to this year and what our target is.
What are some of the key things that a buyer looks for when they're buying a business? We asked a gentleman who's bought a lot of businesses, Ace Chapman, for his ideas.
The two things that we focus on when either we buy a business outright or we go in and invest in a business is we want the operations really to kind of be everything to be there. What we add on top of that is two things. Most people have not spent a lot of time investing or building out their marketing funnel. And the second part of that is having almost like a franchise-like operations manual that allows the person to come in and feel really comfortable that they're going to be able to run the business and take over from where you are. You want to stand out and have those kind of extras that just make it an easy investment for the buyer.
Technology is here to stay, and having a technology plan is becoming very important. Here's expert Jim Blue.
And a lot of people have a business plan, but they don't have a technology plan. What type of equipment do I need? What type of services that I need? A large percentage of my time is helping people brush up on basic computer skills. I help them select the right equipment, programs, and services, really based on their individual needs. And anytime something new comes out, I'm getting phone calls and emails in terms of whether they should upgrade, whether they should get a new product. The name of the game now is setting up a home office. Most people have some type of technology in their home. There's a big difference between using it for personal use and for using it for business use. And I have to really separate that based on how much time someone's going to be spending in their office and what they do for a living.
What are some of the trends because of the global economy? We asked international law expert Kenneth August.
You mentioned manufacturing. That's a perfect example of where the thinking today is very different from where it was even 5 years ago. And by that I mean traditionally a company might look at outsourcing their manufacturing, let's say to China as an example, in order to lower their cost of production.
Mm-hmm.
But really with the consumer markets moving into those countries where they were outsourcing, it makes a lot more sense today to look not at a unilateral outsourcing manufacturing play, but how can you develop a revenue base and profitability in that local market? And maybe instead of doing all your outsourcing in China, you also have manufacturing in Eastern Europe or in Latin America, and they become concentric circles of new markets that you can sell your products and services into.
Most people think of planning for their death when they visit with an estate planning attorney, but here's another viewpoint from estate planning attorney Michael Wittick.
I tell people all the time, you probably came to me to plan for your death when the baby boomer's biggest problem, I think, is disability. In fact, there are things worse than death, and some types of disability fall into that category. They've already done a study in 2014 and determined that in California, the average cost of long-term care is now $94,000. I would say in almost every case, I recommend that people go get a long-term care insurance consultation just so that they can find out, because that's one of the things that is rapidly changing right now to take care of this increased cost. They are repackaging it, and there are new companies in and some older companies that used to offer it are now out of California. Things are changing in that field just like many others.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Well, hey, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you with us. I have some very interesting guests today. My first guest has lived in 46 countries, and including residing in Naples, Italy, and Japan. Currently, he's settled for San Diego, and I'm sure he's happy to be there. He is Frank Caparino. Frank is known around the professional networking group as Franchise Frank for good reason. He started with in franchising with a group with owning Cold Stone Creameries in 1996, and he sold all of those, became a franchise consultant, and he helps people find the correct franchise for their needs. His service is free to his clients. He gets paid by the franchisor. He represents 100 franchises in 20 different industries. And, you know, a lot of you out there are thinking about, what am I going to do once I sell my business, once I exit? Maybe I want to buy another business. So grab a pen and a good piece of paper, a good long piece of paper, and take some notes, because Frank Caparino is going to help us understand more about the franchising world. Frank, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate the opportunity.
It's really my pleasure. You know, we've had some interesting conversations offline, Frank, and I really think this will be interesting for our guests. Tell us about how a little bit more about your interesting background. You've been in several industries, and how did you gravitate towards the franchise world?
Well, good, Bill, because it is an interesting journey. You know, I even teach at some colleges in San Diego State and so forth, and we always tell students and our children and grandchildren to have goals and set goals. But if we all look at our life is kind of a zigzag also, right? It's just the way you move with the economy changing. Well, my bachelor's is in engineering, and that's what brought me around the world. And I have an MBA in finance, and that's what got me into business. But I had a very fortunate position of where I worked for Sperry Univac for 14 years, and the younger listeners might not know that Sperry Univac invented the computer, not IBM, but, you know, they're not around anymore. So they were on every Navy platform. Right. And so I was fortunate enough to ride 300 Navy ships as a civilian, living 3 years in Italy and 4 years in Japan, and always traveling to aircraft carriers, riding submarines. It was the greatest life I've ever had for those years. But, you know, we all have this side of our brain where sometimes we want to be an entrepreneur. And when Ronald Reagan opened up the Defense Department years ago to non-sole source competition, that's when I jumped in, and that's brought me to San Diego, the defense business. Well, I did that for 5 years, and I didn't grow it that rapidly because you have to be going to Washington a lot, not San Diego. And my wife was an RN, so she had a lot of stress. So she said, buy me a Cold Stone Creamery. That's how it started. And in 1996, it's just because I was in San Diego.
Buy me an ice cream store.
Yeah. So because our daughter went to colleges in Arizona, so she knew about Cold Stone Creamery before they came here. So we had a jump. We were number 53 out of 1,400. So that gives me an amazing amount of experience. And I built to 8 franchises, 8 Cold Stone Creameries, because the SBA loans were flowing rather well in 96 with a good economy, just like it is now. And that's what, so I can help people in all different areas, not only selling the franchise, but how to finance them, as well as how to get retail space for them or get franchises without retail space, because that's where I've had experience, and that's what differentiates me from other franchise brokers or salespeople, because I'm in it. I was in it for years, and I'm still in another franchise.
And Frank, from what I understand, you represent 100 different franchise brands. Give us a little bit of overview. How many do you think there are overall? How many franchises? I mean, I've gone to the Franchise Expo here in Anaheim at the convention center, and it was like three full floors of franchises. I was blown away at the number of franchises. How many do you think there are out there existing today?
Well, because it grows all the time, but some fold too. So a lot of it is about 3,500 franchises. So,
wow.
And some of them, you know, are kind of ridiculous, like painting bottles and then having a wine party. I mean, who am I to say some of that is growing up? They have robots now that make yoga and you put them at an airport. How are you going to rent an airport? See, people hear this stuff. They hear a radio advertisement and they gravitate towards, wow, I'm going to have a robot that makes yogurt, and I can put it at the San Diego or the LAX and make a fortune and not be around. Well, that's not going to happen. The rent at an airport is the most expensive place in the world. And if you read their legal document, they said, if you're so successful, we can take that territory back. So these are the things I'm trying to always help people with, to pick the right franchise. Ones that I've vetted every 6 months in different cities around the country, we meet with our 100 franchisors. So we know them inside and out, and they know us. So that's how we are different.
Now, one thing I've heard from you is that most people, and I associate this too, I think of franchises, I think of food and food products, like you mentioned, the robo-yogo type of a thing. So, but from what I've heard from you, you represent 100 franchises, but only four of them are food. So that means 96% of what you represent is not food. Do they have a better bottom line than food? Why are so many of the franchises you represent not food? And give us a kind of an example of the different industries they do serve.
Sure. First of all, food, if it was perfect, if everything was running perfectly, you have a 20% bottom line. Well, if you have a Subway, a McDonald's, I mean, let's not put them down. They're the biggest in the world. But, I mean, it's perfect to get 20%, but now you got to pay 8% to the franchisor, so you're down to 12%. And 12% on a good volume is still a good return. But how about your minimum wage worker? Are they going to work for you? You're going to get the efficiency you want? No, I doubt it, because I had 150 teenagers working for me in the summer. Not putting down the teenagers, that's why I'd never be in food again. But what's more important to you, I ask, Bill, when they get a text, is that more important to them or the customer they're looking at? And I know you know the answer. So that's kind of why I don't really like food. Now, what's the other areas we're in? Personally, I'm in a franchise again with partners in Mission Viejo called My Salon Suites. You actually build salons of 100 square feet in a big building for the hairdressers, nail technicians, and estheticians, and so forth in that industry. And they rent from you, but you have no employees. You have a cleaning service. And that's the difference, you know. So Sacramento, or any state capital, can't screw around with the minimum wage and affect your bottom line and your cost of goods. That's kind of – now – other ones I deal with, fitness space. I have like 12 in the fitness space. Senior care. Things that are Amazon protected. I mean, Amazon's not going to do fitness. And that's one of the biggest growing areas, family fitness and boutique fitness, meaning one function, like spin classes, Pilates, and so forth. So we also do consulting franchises, and you've seen those. We have them in our networking group, like Sanders and Focal Point. Those are consulting franchises. And then we could have the hair salons that are small, the name that everybody knows, Supercut, one of the biggest names in the world. Those kind of single or barbershops, because they're recession-proof. Even if you lose your job, you got to look good, and hair is always recession-proof.
Right. Yeah, and I've heard that pretty soon all the strip malls will be hairdressers and and food. You know, everything else will be delivered by a drone. So here's the question, because all of these ideas and all these businesses started from, I imagine, started from a small business, and then they developed a franchise. So the question, I guess, is why should I buy a franchise? Can't I just come up with an idea and do it myself? What do I get if I buy a franchise that's better than just doing it myself?
Well, I usually have three patented answers, and I teach a course called Franchise Management at San Diego State, and we talk about this. The three things that I ask my students at any time during the course, what makes a franchise different? Number one, branding, because somebody who goes into New York knows your brand if you're big enough or when you're big enough in San Diego, okay? And you got the same standards. They should get the same food. They should get the same haircut. They should get the same service. Number two, it's the SBA and the financing piece of it. SBA loves franchises, and people ask, well, why? Why wouldn't they love my business? In fact, my business might be more profitable because I don't pay royalties. Well, but a franchise has one thing bankers love. They have statistics. They have in the document you sign with a franchise called the Item 19, they disclose average unit volume of all their locations across the country. It gives the banker a confidence level, an audible level, and he knows what the finance is going to do as opposed to your Mapa, coffee shop that opened yesterday. And the third thing is asset value when you go sell it. If you buy into a franchise like I did in Coldstone, where they maxed out San Diego to 40 units, once you get after 40, people can't go into that territory anymore. People want to buy your franchise, and the asset value goes up because they know about the demand. And those are the three things, Bill, I think really help with a franchise.
Those are great tips. Now, one of those things you mentioned was with regards to the ease of financing and the SBA. Is that typically how people finance their franchise? Is SBA pretty popular, or are there other ways that people finance their franchise?
Depends on the franchise. That's why I spend almost 3 hours over several phone calls interviewing my candidates before I suggest three franchises. That's all. I don't want them to get more than that, but I suggest three that they can look at. The SBA franchise will back any franchise I have except the salon suites that I'm personally in because there's no employees. Obviously, government things like SBA love generating employees. It's a political thing they got to talk about, right? So I have 4 out of 100 that I can't finance with SBA, but the other 96 you can. And when I tell my candidates, I say this is going to cost $100,000 for you to get in, I tell them, remember, you put in 25% and we can finance 75. I don't want them to get blown away by the cost of something. So because they have to put in 25%. Now, in other ways to do it, which this is one of my big markets for executives who are coming out of corporate America, or they like their job in corporate America, but they want kind of a semi-absentee executive model to run with a general manager, they can roll over their 401ks. So I work with four financial partners, some roll over 401ks, penalty-free, no problem with the IRS, they've been doing it for 30 years. So people have a big 401k, they can fund the business with it, nothing out of pocket. And we have partners to help you do that.
That's interesting. So there's a lot of ideas, and you don't have to, think of borrowing from friends and relatives necessarily. There's abilities out there to get financing. So, Frank, let me ask you a question. If someone came to you and said, Frank, I'm thinking about going into, buying a franchise, should I be looking for the hot upcoming trending new franchise that hasn't hit this area yet, like you did with Coldstone Creamery, it sounds like, way back when? Or should I look for a sure thing that's already established? What are some of the qualifiers that you would tell people they should think about?
Well, that's during my consultation. I'm trying to find, their risk averseness. And I also say, can we talk to you about your spouse? Can you put them on the line? Because I want to make sure that one person is risky and the other person is not. And to answer that question, if I tell them, if you want to buy a fad like one I sold that comes out of the valley up in Sherman Oaks, Medici's, which is like live in a Napoli, the pizza is so good. Everything in it comes from Naples, a pizzeria. Well, pizzeria is a hard business to run. And they keep saying, well, there's a lot of competition. Well, if you get in with a new product and the area gets maxed out, because they sold 400 locations, it did get maxed out, you can be one of the first, and then you're going to, when people want to get into that in that county, you can sell out quickly. I tell them, if you get a fad, when your sales keep climbing, but they go a little south, don't make the mistake I did. I made some mistakes. I didn't sell all my 8 Cold Stone Creameries at a profit, big profit, which I could have. Go south a little. That's why I give them my history. Sell. Now, if you have an established one like a Supercuts that have been around forever, you have a clientele, you don't have to sell because your revenue should be increasing at least by the inflationary level and be a pretty good income for you. So that's how, you know, either established and hold it, or if it's a fad, if you see it's changing, sell out at the top.
Bottom line, there's a lot of things to think about, and that's why you want to talk to somebody like Frank. Frank, you have a couple of client stories for us that I think you wanted to share with us. I'd love to hear those.
Well, yeah, because and some of them are fun because I also, with my years of being overseas, I kind of work with immigration lawyers because, you know, it gets me, like, for instance, my one, I love her name, Gabriella Buonasorte, right? It's like living in Italy again.
Yeah.
From Palermo. And she wanted an E-2 visa. An E-2 visa means you got to have a small business. And if you put about $100,000 at risk, that's about the size of the business you got to put at risk. You might, with an immigration lawyer, you should get an E-2 visa if everything else checks out. She's now living in Pasadena. That took like 4 months to do. It's not a 5-minute thing because it's government oriented. But she's now has a daughter in a private school in Pasadena. That was her big goal, and she's working a Budget Blinds, which is another big name that we carry that's been around a long time. So
sure.
A second one, yeah, is these partnerships that I put together now because the My Salon Suites that I own in Mission Viejo with partners, and I've sold out all San Diego County too. It's a capital intensive business. Every site is like $1 million to build, which we got commercial loans on from Pacific Western. So I put partnerships together so it's not that capital intense and sell like a 5 or 6 pack. That way, when all 5 are developed, they'd be making the income as if they made one, owned one, but they look great to the bank during those 5 build outs. So I like doing that, putting partnerships together. And my last one quickly, Bill, is in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, because I sell around the country. They put in a modernizing dry cleaning franchise of mine, and she gave up a $300,000 job. You try to find people that can do that because she traveled so much, had so much stress in the communications business that she wanted her own business. And modernizing dry cleaning, she did her research. There wasn't much dry cleaning competition, and that's like making her life better.
That's fantastic, and that's what a lot of people, of course, are looking for these days. They're saying, hey, I'm not ready to retire. I want to rewire. I want to rewire my life, simplify, and own a small business so I have something to do and some source of income coming in. So, Frank, you have some tips, ideas, or precautions for us. Could you share those with our listeners?
Okay. The tips are if you're working with other people that you're buying a franchise that's a resale or you're working with other brokers, and I'm not the exclusive broker. There's a lot in this country. But what you have to do is do the validation process. You got the broker talking to you. You have the franchisor talking to you. You go to a discovery day and get real excited. But the validation process is where you call the existing franchisees that are in the document you're going to sign. Before you sign, call them. I have a book on the internet, How to Buy a Franchise, 24 Tips to Beware of Before Signing. That, and I will send, if anybody sends me an email for it, I will definitely send you an ebook of that. So, again, my email is easy, frank@franchisefrank.com.
That is easy.
The validation process is I want you to do that. Make sure you talk to franchisees. They'll tell you the story. Financing. Make sure, like when you talk with myself or anybody else, can you do an SBA, can you do a commercial loan, or can you do a rollover? That is one of my big things if you have a 401k. And please pick the correct industry. Pick something for my third tip that's not Amazon. You know, it has to be Amazon-proof is the word nowadays. Well, like we said, stuff that's recession-proof, hair, you know, and non-food and consulting, things that you can do every day no matter what the economy is.
It's amazing what you can learn in 20 minutes by listening to an expert, and Frank Caparino is certainly an expert in this space. So give us that email again, Frank. It's easy. Give it to us one more time.
Okay, Frank, F-R-A-N-K, at franchisefrank.com, F-R-A-N-C-H-I-S-E-F-R-A-N-K.com, and you can go to that website also.
Everybody can remember that. So Franchise Frank, thank you so much. And you also have offered to give our listeners this free ebook for whoever writes you an email to request it. Heard it on Exit Coach Radio. And Frank is also very well connected, as he belongs to a large professional networking group called Provisors that connects professionals all over the place. So if you have another need, ask Frank for that as well. Frank, thank you so much for all this great information. It's really been a pleasure talking with you, and I feel like it went by so fast, we ought to probably schedule another one and talk more about what's going on in the franchise world at some point in the future.
Great. Same to you and your audience, Bill. Thank you very much.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this. Please stay with us.
Hey, everybody, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you with us, as always. You're in for a real treat now. We're going to learn about some very interesting legal tips from an expert. He is Peter Sahin from Velasco Law Group out of Los Angeles, and also other offices within the Southern California area. And Peter's an expert. He's in the business of helping clients through the complex legal challenges of estate and succession planning. And we're going to talk about common legal problems you can save your family from with some smart planning. So, Peter, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Bill. Pleasure to be here.
It's a real pleasure. Pleasure is all mine. We've talked offline, you shared some great tips and ideas with me that I thought, you know, our listeners really need to know about this, because, you know, when you start developing assets, when you build up a business, that becomes part of what's called your estate. And without doing some planning, there are some, let's call them creditors and predators, that could have their way with that estate if you don't protect it and things go wrong. So we're going to talk about those issues. But before we do, Peter, tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into the field of law, and what type of clients you typically work with.
Yes, so I really came into the legal field through my own family, you know, real estate business, so to speak, and decided to get the law degree to kind of help out with really our own family business. But now I spend most of my time helping clients really avoid some of the lengthy courtroom drama that can happen when there's a death or an incapacity of a family member. So I'm a certified specialist in estate planning. Typically, I'm working with clients on the planning side to avoid that sort of scenario and then helping them get through any issues like that after the fact, try to move things forward for everybody in the best way we can.
Well, you know, that's all we can ask for is to have a professional on our side when we need you. And does your firm work with a lot of business owners? I know that you have a Long Beach office that works with a lot of people that are business owners, right?
Yes, that's most definitely a fairly large component of our clientele. I mean, we work with a whole range of folks. Sometimes they have, you know, your traditional businesses with corporations, LLCs. Often, you know, a lot of real estate is common as well. But we also do a lot of work, you know, for your everyday, folks around the neighborhood that you might know as well that maybe just, you know, have more of a normal, modest wealth accumulation situation. But the same issues still need to be navigated, you know, regardless of what you have. With businesses, of course, there's a little more to it, and it becomes more critical to spend that time and get the right person involved for sure.
And I'm sure you've been involved with, as I have, situations where people have died suddenly and own a business and didn't do their planning, or maybe they did. Maybe they had done their trust planning, but it has been a long time since they've done that planning. So tell us, what are some common avoidable after-death issues that you see with folks that have actually done some planning during life with a living trust?
Yeah, I mean, a big one that I've really see a lot of recently that might draw people into wanting to take a look at their situation is I come across a lot of trust administrations, you know, post-death where the decedent has died, and most of their wealth is really in California real estate. In many cases, you know, the wishes that they've outlined in their trust maybe, which is pretty common, if they have multiple children, for example, would be for each of those children to really share in the property of their trust equally. Of course, living here as we do in Southern California, I often see that there's a lot of valuable real estate in that trust that might have been purchased, you know, by the parents or maybe even their grandparents of the receiving children a really long time ago. So the issue or the planning opportunity in cases like this that frankly is rarely addressed in trusts that I see really relates to the real property tax reassessment options when a decedent owns property and passes away. So in California, for those listeners that don't know, you know, we've got a situation where property that transfers by sale or inheritance to a new owner gets a new tax rate, you know, based on the current property values. And that's almost always going to be higher than what's reflected on the prior owner's tax register because real estate's just always going up higher around here. Mm-hmm. And this really has to do with our tax laws, which basically allow only incremental increases if the ownership doesn't transfer. But a common exception to that rule in the assessor's definition is that when property is passing from a parent to a child, that is really not considered a transfer in their eyes. So to take advantage of this and add flexibility in the trust, if a parent really knows, or I would say even suspects in advance, that you know one of their children may be both willing and able to possibly buy out their other siblings and you know keep this family home that's been in the family rather than selling it, we can draft a buyout option in the trust. And without such an option, they're really looking at a lot of challenges to try and keep the entirety, you know, that child keeping the entirety of their parents' nice low property tax rate when the sibling wants to buy out their other siblings.
Right.
Because the assessor's office is really going to view that buyout as a sibling-to-sibling transfer, which is not exempt. So when we custom draft an option like this, it really allows the children to use funds from a new standard mortgage that they may get on the property, or maybe their own personal savings, or maybe a refi from their other side property that they own. And then they can retain 100% of their parents' tax rates. Without a provision like this, basically you're looking at either losing thousands and thousands of property tax savings over a period of time, or they're going to be dependent on quite a bit of cooperation from the trustee and the other siblings to navigate, I would say, what's really a pretty complicated legal and also financial step, a series of transactions involving what amounts to a very high interest hard money loan to pull it off.
So let me back up just a second there. I get what you're saying. I want to make sure our listeners get it. So what you're saying is that, let's say somebody bought their original house for, let's say, $100,000, and now it's worth $1 million, and their property taxes have been based on that $100,000 plus a very small amount of increase, but the properties may be appreciated much, much more than that, which would cause, under normal circumstances, the child now to pay taxes on the $1 million value on an annual basis, which is substantial, even though they may have just inherited the property, maybe free and clear, but their property taxes are going to go way up. So what you're saying is that with a special buyout provision, and my question is going to come in a second, with that special buyout provision, they can retain the parents' tax basis, and then I would imagine they can't then pass it on in the next generation. You can't retain that forever, I would imagine, but maybe you're going to tell me differently. But my question is, does that have to be done outside of the trust between the parent and that particular child or children, or can that be done inside of the trust with this special provision?
It actually should be in the trust. We would carve out really an option right in here. And just for the listeners, the fact pattern, I should say, that you're really looking for to issue spot to see if maybe this should be in my trust would be, one, you've got more than one child. I mean, if you've just got one child, all the property is going to go to them. You won't have this issue. Two, you've probably got more real estate value than cash, because let's just say you've got two children, but house is worth $1 million and you've got 1.2 in cash. Well, that's not really going to be an issue for you either, because you can allocate enough cash to the one child if your trust reads 50-50 to my two children, So if you've got those two scenarios and you think, one child may actually want to keep the property, putting a provision like this in the trust really makes it so much easier, because they can just get an appraisal, agree to the buyout amounts. And, if you've only got one house in your trust and no other cash, then the child can just get a new loan on it, or they can use their own funds and then buy out their sibling. Meanwhile, they get 100% of the low tax rate versus possibly only getting half, for their because the assessor is going to see the trust that says 50-50 to each child. Each of you get half a property, so to speak. But then without a provision like this, if you swap, and buy out your sibling, that transaction right there is what trips you up, and they're going to reassess half.
This is a very interesting topic, Peter. I'm sure most of our listeners, if they've looked at a living trust, they glaze over by about the fourth page of probably a 40-page document. What particular area should they be looking for, or provision? Maybe there's a table of contents in the trust. What would this be called for them to identify and see? Maybe they can find that there is this provision, or maybe they realize it's lacking in their current trust, or their parents' trust, I should say.
Sure. Usually you're going to see it as a buyout option titled provision, something of that nature. It may also be named perhaps, a right of first refusal. Any of those sorts of terms are what you're really looking for.
And in your experience, what percentage would you venture of trust have this versus don't have this, where they should have this, but they don't have it?
Well, it's interesting because the Board of Equalization, which really rendered kind of an opinion on this and a rule within their statutes, only really came down with it, I think, in 2013. So it's fairly new in terms of a planning strategy. And I haven't seen any trusts other than ones that I've been reworking for folks lately that have something like this.
So in any event, if you have a trust that is dated before 2013, of course, many, many of our listeners did their trust planning a long time ago, thought they were all set, and they should have reviewed it anyways because there have been many changes in estate planning overall, correct?
There have, yes.
Yeah, and going along with your estate planning package is often things like advanced health care directives and powers of attorney, and all of those rules have changed pretty drastically as well. So it's probably time for a review, and this will be a question to put into your review questions is, hey, should I have this buyout option or right of first refusal in my trust to help my child retain my tax basis on my residence or my property? Sounds
Absolutely.
Like a no-brainer
yeah.
to me. So you're giving us some great information here, Peter. Is there another lesser-known trust drafting option that you wish more people were aware of?
Sure. I mean, a lot of people maybe on the call may be aware of what are called AB trusts. We've had some changes in our tax laws for death taxes or estate taxes recently that have pushed up the limits and made a lot more flexibility with couples that have trusts, spouses. One of the things that I see frequently are a lot of couples, though, that have blended families, you've got a set of children from one spouse only. Now, from a planning perspective, almost all married couples typically do want to leave their collective marital assets for the surviving spouse's lifetime needs. But the issue with blended families you can have is balancing that goal with also protecting and securing, the ultimate inheritance for the children of the first spouse that passes, who may not be the same children of the second, Now, if the trust allows the spouse with open-ended options, in other words, to redirect the distribution during their lifetime, when they're, to their own beneficiaries, for example, when they die, then, and that's something that most fully revocable trusts do, there's a high likelihood those children of the first could be disinherited. So what we can sometimes do for clients that are in this situation is what we're drafting now is a hybrid, fully revocable trust for couples like this. So it's really merging together a couple of nice benefits. On the one hand, it stays revocable throughout both spouses' life. So what that means is when one spouse dies, it's very simplified for them. There's no valuations of their assets and businesses that are needed at that point in time. No extra tax filings, other than their normal IRS under their own social filings. Very minimal attorney work as well. But on the other hand, we include a binding provision that really restricts them from redirecting the balance of the trust assets when they die. Or I should say the deceased spouse is usually half of the balance, away from who that spouse really wanted it to go to when they first died. So it restricts them essentially from fully disinheriting, the first spouse's directions on that point.
Yeah, and it's an interesting point. I have clients that had the AB trust back when it was more of a necessity for estate tax exemption preservation, when the exemptions were very low, and their spouse died, and they didn't really like the B trust because all of a sudden it was created an inflexible situation. Didn't prevent them from getting to the assets if they needed to, but it created a lot of administrative nightmares for that. And so the question is, well, how do we take care of those children of the spouse? And so here you have something called, what is it, the hybrid fully revocable trust? Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's what we call it. I've never really seen a term for it, but that is what we're internally at our office really referring to it as. And it's been popular and quite useful for a lot of a lot of couples.
Well, what's coming out of this conversation is that the Valesco Law Group and Peter Sahin have ideas and strategies that are for today's couples that might be blended marriages, like you say, that have children from previous marriages. There's only a few of those in California. I'm just kidding. So you have one other tip for us today, and we're running short because that was such an interesting segment about the tax reassessment option. What, you know, when business owners or family members die, emotions run high. People get into disputes. What single decision is the most important for minimizing litigation when family harmony is unlikely following a death?
Sure. I mean, since I litigate in this area, I see it on the back end a lot, but I think the single decision you really want to put a lot of energy into is who should be your successor, trustees and, you know, powers of attorney if you're incapacitated. So who should be really the finance, legal, and money manager of your trust, certainly mm-hmm. when you die? You know, there's a lot of, among families, there can be a lot of hardship and mistrust, jealousy, suspicion, all kinds of emotion when you put, for example, one child in that role and the others are just going to put a target on their back, essentially. So, you know, that I'm not saying that isn't wrong in all cases, but in some cases, if you can see a storm coming, you may be better off really putting a trusted professional fiduciary in place instead. Let them be the target. You know, they know how to handle it. They're going to also probably administer this trust a lot quicker and probably for a lot less money to avoid all that litigation, you know.
So I've seen a lot of trusts that say, okay, if I die, my spouse takes over. If we both die, then a child or children could be successor trustees. And if they don't want to or they can't, then it would go to a professional trustee, sometimes a trust company. But I think there's a lot of trust companies that have a lot coming at them they're not aware of. What you're saying is maybe bring in a trusted professional. Would you say like an accountant or an attorney or someone like that who could be the referee in those situations and make decisions that's familiar with the family as a trusted advisor?
Yeah, that would certainly be a good choice. I mean, typically you want to go with somebody that has met with you and spoken with you and that you trust and you know that they're going to follow all your wishes and understand a little bit of your business when the time comes. It can be a CPA. Attorneys, there are some attorneys that are very good at this that do it for a living, but your traditional estate planning attorney that's doing like what I do wouldn't serve in this role just to avoid, you know, being a, you know, complicating kind of their position on things. But there are some really good fiduciaries that are licensed, bonded, and you can find them also that are on the Secretary of State's website as well. Attorneys, though, can do it without licensing on there, on that site. But meet with your attorney.
Does Valesco Law take on this responsibility if requested by clients?
No, we do not typically. I mean,
okay.
Some of us do for our own family, but we would help you to mm-hmm. find a really good fit based on
okay.
your location and your situation and make sure that you meet with them and like them before you put them in place.
So it's a good idea. You know, don't engage in it. It's not a time for amateur hour. These things can get very heated, and you need somebody who can really interpret the documents that have been put forth as kind of the rule book for what should happen. It's great advice. And, Peter, unfortunately, we're out of time today, but you've given us such great tips and ideas that, you know, things that I have not heard yet, and I really appreciate you coming on. Tell us how best to get in touch with you if someone had a question or they wanted to find out more about the Valesco Law Group.
Yeah, you can absolutely call our main office line, and we'll have a complimentary hour-long consultation on whether it's estate planning or anything else in the estate and trust arena. It's 562-432-5541. We've got an office in downtown Long Beach, in Downey, and also in Irvine. You can also find us on our website, which is www.Valesco, V-E-L-A-S-C-O, lawgroup.com. And my email is simply peter@valescolawgroup.com.
Fantastic information. And I got to have you back sometime because we just scratched the surface of some of these ideas. But I really enjoyed it, and I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your great wisdom with our listeners today, Peter. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure, Bill. Thank you for having me.
All right. We are going to go right into our next guest today. We're going to go from the area of law to the area of accounting. And let me ask you a question. When you think of your accounting firm, your CPA firm, when you think of them, what do you think of? This firm, the partner for this firm we're going to talk about, has built their success on providing every client with the value of experience. It doesn't matter if you're big or small, their core operating philosophy means that they offer every client the same consideration and depth of expertise under a fee structure that delivers maximum value for middle market companies. Now, some people say, well, my accountant doesn't charge a lot. You know, it's not about the fee. It's about the expertise and the wisdom that you're getting. So my next guest is Wayne Pennell, who is the managing partner at Haskell & White, which has offices all over Southern California. And he became the managing partner in 2004, following 8 years as a partner in the firm's audit and business advisory services group. And as managing partner, Wayne oversees the overall strategic direction and operations of the firm while continuing to serve clients in his role as an audit partner. I'm very honored to have him back on the show today. Wayne, thank you so much for joining me today.
Bill, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
It's always my pleasure. You guys do such great work. I hear so many great comments from business owners about the type of work that you do, and you're all over Southern California. Tell us a little bit more about Haskell & White and about the types of clients that you work with.
Sure, and as far as all over Southern California, we certainly get around through the two offices we have, really, one in Irvine, which is our headquarters, the founded office, really, and our second office in San Diego. But our client base extends into L.A. County. Quite frankly, it extends up the West Coast and a little bit to some states a little bit east of here. But our clientele is, as you pointed out, is traditionally middle market, but it's privately held companies, it's publicly held companies. Along those lines, we also handle a number of nonprofits. So our industry coverage runs from real estate to technology, manufacturing, life science, a pretty good breadth of industries that we cover throughout that process.
And today we're going to talk a little bit, Wayne, about preparing middle market businesses for sale. For exit, I should say, because a lot of baby boomers, of course, listeners of this show, are saying, I know how I got into this business. I'm not sure, you know, the best way to get out of it. And, of course, the economy is strong. People are saying, you know, this might be the time to be exploring this seriously. So tell us a little bit about how a business owner would know when it's time to start preparing for their inevitable exit from the middle market business.
Thanks. I'll try to do that. It really, I think a business owner should be planning ahead as much as they can because you might look at it, they're going to exit the business someday somehow, and it can be orderly or disorderly. And so the best way to plan for it would be to have a solid plan in place that might contemplate several different structures, whether it's a family transfer because it's a family-owned company and there are sons and daughters coming up in the business that could take it over, whether it's a sale to a private equity firm, sourced through a deal through an investment banker, or even those that decide that their exit strategy really is to take the company public. All of those really should have a long-term plan in place. And in fact, I would say if you enter the business, probably a good time to think about the exit is when you start it. What are your goals really going to be? And that's kind of fuzzy for companies or owners if they're going to be in there for the long haul, 10, 20, 30 years. But certainly 3 to 5 years before they plan to get out of the business would be not too early to start planning how they're going to get out of that business.
And let me ask you, because you know, in 2008, there was no E in the EBITDA. That means no earnings in the formula. Nobody was making any money, so it was hard to sell a business because people were buying on multiples of earnings. Things have changed quite a bit in the last 10 years. Almost everybody in business I talk to is very, very busy right now. Are you getting a lot more requests? Are you seeing that in the firm, that you're getting a lot more requests for people saying, hey, this might be a good time for me to explore this?
Well, yes, certainly. And there's really a couple of different things going on. As you mentioned, back in 2008, with the downturn in the economy, the earnings disappeared. Folks that were anticipating maybe selling in 2009, 2010, lost a lot of value in their companies, realized that they probably needed to put a little bit more blood, sweat, and tears into it for another few years, build the value back up. And so those folks that were getting ready to exit, you know, 10 years ago, they're probably really anxious now if they haven't gotten out. Meanwhile, people that were 10 years younger than them are also getting to the crest of their careers looking to exit. So you do hear a lot of stories out there about private equity firms having dry powder, meaning they've got a lot of money sitting on the side. They're looking to deploy it. We have been very active with consultations with companies discussing their exits, and actually have worked on a number of sale transactions over the past couple of years. But back to a prior point I made, though, if you wait until somebody shows up with an offer in hand and you haven't really planned for it, you're kind of behind the eight ball getting ready for it.
Really good point. So at the intersection of aging and economics, where people are saying, you know, I was ready in 2008. Now I'm really ready. or you know, I don't want to, if I'm going to plan, it's going to be a five-year plan, I know I'm going to be ready in 5 years. And the issue becomes, well, are there enough buyers, or is it going to be so many sellers that a buyer is really going to have a pick of a lot of people going up for sale? And so the issue becomes, as you say, you better have done your homework and get it ready so that when a buyer comes along and looks at you, they're not going to say, you know, this business is just, it's sloppy, it's just not ready. They haven't been working with their professionals like at Haskell & White. They really aren't going to be attractive to us. So what are some of the biggest mistakes and overlooked steps that entrepreneurs and executives miss when they're getting ready to exit their companies?
Well, I think covering what you just said, let me put it back in a different way, because you hit really three broad factors of what's going to drive the right time to sell a company. One is, if we're talking about a sole proprietor, family-owned business that's getting ready to exit, they need to be personally ready. And so one thing that's in there is a lot of times you'll ask somebody what they do or who they are, and they'll recite to you what they do for a living. And so personally speaking, emotionally speaking, they may not be ready to see the day after the sale, especially if they exit, because there's going to be a loss of identity that they need to be prepared for. Second thing that was wrapped in what you're saying is the company ready? And I'll come back to that, because there's a number of things they can focus on for the company being ready that'll assist through focusing on different, what we might call, value drivers. And then that third thing that you really covered was the changes and tides in the economy, because you might be ready personally. You might have got your company really in good form, making good profits and cleaning up some other things. And, you know, we have another downturn in the market, so where there's no buyers that want to buy what you have to offer at that point. So from a long-range planning, the most perhaps frustrating point of that is you can't predict the economy. You can't predict with any certainty what the dollar is going to be worth, what your company is going to be worth several years out. But if you start planning now, looking at what truly drives the value, do you have a product that somebody wants to buy, a product or service that somebody wants to buy? Do you have an excellent mode of distribution or service delivery that is, you know, maybe got something a little bit unique to it? Do you have a great management team? You know, one way to measure that as the owner of the company is, can you step away from the company tomorrow and know that the company will run and survive without you having your hands in it? Because that's what the buyer is going to look for when they take the company or take over the company from you. You know, looking at, you know, the innards of the company, you know, is it got a good governance system, everything from its accounting systems to its ability to maintain contract files, meet regulatory objectives, timely tax returns, complete tax returns, covering all the various types of things, not just income taxes, but payroll, sales, you name it, special regulatory reports and all that. Is all that stuff in place? Going back to what I said earlier, if that stuff is not ready, and I've had a number of clients come with, you know, I just got a call and somebody sent me an LOI, they'd like to buy my company. You have no time to address any of that stuff. You're probably leaving money on the table at that point.
Yeah, and the person that is looking at that company is probably going to look and see if some of these things are in order. So you said a mouthful there, Wayne. There's a lot of points in that last segment, and I think of it like a slot machine. We're all familiar with slot machines. If all the cherries line up, then you win the jackpot, right? So the three are personally ready. Is your company ready and in good order? And is the economy ready? If all those three things line up, then you have the best chance of winning the jackpot. If not, you might get a quarter.
The other spin to that too might be just the financial part, because a lot of owners, I will say, have uneducated guess as to what their business is worth, and so they're expecting to get this offer that's going to satisfy them through retirement and beyond. That is probably sometimes well beyond what the company's going to go for. So that's the other thing to really get in check, is what is the possible sale value, and if you could figure out a way to increase that by boosting that E, as you mentioned before, just a little bit each year on a multiple basis. If you got a multiple of 5, to do simple math, if you increase it by 100, that's 500. It doesn't take a lot of extra brain power to figure that out.
But it does, and it does bring in an interesting issue, and that is to do that, I may have to pay more taxes. I may have to increase my bottom line, which is taxable, which I've been running my business all my life to minimize that. There's a change. There's a transition that happens for a lot of owners. But my real question is when a buyer comes along, how much more comfort level would they have if they saw audited financials versus what we would call compiled or reviewed financial statements for that business?
Sure. I mean, in our business, obviously, the audit is the premier service. I think that is where the highest level of credibility would be out there for a company to be able to say they go through that rigor on an annual basis. Reviews are good. Audits would probably be great. Reviews are good, and I think compilations are really not worth a whole lot. The buyer will see, okay, there's an accounting firm involved, but if it's only a compilation, and if you read that report, it really almost gets down to where it says the accountant didn't do anything except put some words on a piece of paper. I try to actively not sell those. But reviews and audits definitely would push the meter up, just from an initial impression, if nothing else, that the company has gone through a little bit of extra effort. Can you sell the company without being audited or reviewed? Sure. But having those in place, having a system, an annual reporting cycle, a series of those for the last several years certainly increases that credibility as well.
Yeah, and again, in the supply and demand world, so much is about the confidence in those numbers, and the confidence is heightened when accounting professionals have combed through those numbers and verified all of those numbers. So there comes a turning point for a lot of owners, and one gentleman wrote an excellent book from Mercer Capital about value. He's a valuation expert, called the 1% solution. He said there comes a point when you can make more money by investing in certain things in your business as opposed to making more money. and the concept was, there comes a point when an audited financial or as you mentioned, just upping your game in that area, getting your standard operating procedures, getting your people dialed in and maybe even your key people locked in to and past a sale, are going to give a buyer much more confidence that the business is going to sustain beyond current ownership. And that's where you get your money back. That's where it becomes an investment as opposed to an expense. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's fair to say. And if you really think about it, the buyer is going to get some money to sell his company. I'm sorry, the seller is getting the money to sell his company. The buyer is making an investment for the long term. They need a recovery period. And if they buy something that's not going to operate as good or better than it was under the prior owner, they're going to have a hard time recouping that investment. So it has to be, well run to be taken over and advanced or grown or become even more profitable. And another example, look as to people sell a house maybe frequently during the time of their lifetime. And one of the things they do in their home before they sell it is they will fix things. They will remodel things, kitchens and bathrooms, for example. Should should be doing the same thing with the business, and the business is probably one thing you're going to sell maybe once. I mean, it's a much bigger, much more complicated sale, but it's certainly worthy of the same attention for improvement.
As managing partner of the firm, are you kind of looking into the future and forecasting the number of these types of exit transactions increasing by some kind of a factor into the next decade?
Well, I wish I had as good a crystal ball as anybody else, and perhaps I probably do. But I do see that this trend will increase for some period of time. I can't give you a factor rate on that, but we do have aging in America. We see it from a standpoint of a lot of studies will say that the millennial generation, which is our next up-and-comer, is actually now going to be the largest generation that we've had. But if you think about the age difference between the millennials in their, you know, mid to late 20s and the baby boomers, if you will, that are now, you know, hitting their 70s and beyond, there's a big gap in between of maybe potential buyers, because that generation in between is smaller. So I think some of these transactions are going to be a little bit more interesting. There might be fewer person-to-person sales, maybe more institutional players involved, maybe some more roll-ups. I think private equity is probably going to have another few years of boom, all that tempered with who has the best crystal ball for what government, social, economic effects are going to have on all of those potential deals.
Well, without climbing too far out on a limb, and one issue or one trend that's becoming apparent is that as the baby boomers age, retirement and, or like I say, I call it rewiring instead of retiring, is on their minds a lot. And a lot of them may attempt to sell to that outside buyer, but maybe they didn't win the beauty contest because there were just too many contestants. I think, Wayne, you probably hear now that, like I do, that very few, maybe 10% of people that go to a business broker or an M&A firm actually sell through that medium at this point, and that's projected to those numbers are projected to go even lower. So as the number of baby boomers head to exit, there's only so many transactions the M&A market can handle. And so my question for you would be, do you project or think that there will be an increase in the number of legacy businesses where buyers say, I can't sell, so I'm going to go part-time, I'm going to try to pass it off to my key employees or children? And if so, how can business owners prepare for that type of a transaction best?
Yeah, well, you know, that's, you throw that back onto the list of potential exits. I think certainly family members is a good one. There's a lot of family office environments out there that own businesses that have, you know, substantial net worths, that have family up and coming, that those things do happen. Management buyout, certainly that's not a new thing. I think a limitation that has to be dealt with on management is the financing for management. So there may be some steps the owner can be looking at now as to how to do an appropriate financial structure, which would need some advice from, you know, accounting, tax, legal, and the banking minds to try to put something in play for that. We shouldn't discount strategic buyers, certainly. I think a lot of folks might end up in a strategic play because they end up selling in a vertical chain with a vendor or customer they already have. I've had that happen a number of times over the last 10, 15 years where you might go out and source another buyer, but you end up doing the deal with the folks you know. So I think all of those possibilities should be perhaps on the table and maybe start ranking them out as to which are the most likely scenarios. There's probably some common, well, there is common planning that can be done for any one of those potential outcomes.
Yes, good point. Getting started on your planning is the key. I saw an interesting speaker long ago that talked about that businesses tend to live in different value worlds depending on what their transfer strategy is going to be. For instance, how to increase your value if you're selling to an ESOP or a private equity group or an outside buyer or a strategic buyer as opposed to selling or transferring to an insider group like family members or key employees. So it's important to get with your professionals early and determine, you know, what is your anticipated plan A and plan B for transfer strategies and start understanding how you need to position yourself for those. Wayne, do you see and do you facilitate having the teams get together. A lot of times we talk to a business owner and they say, well, my attorney's over here, my accountant's over here. They've never met. They don't really get together. Do you see that as a trend? I know you do that a lot with Haskell & White and try to bring the advisor team together to work in a cohesive method for the benefit of the business owner.
Well, you know, I think it's imperative that you know, even if we're working on our accounting world only, if we're doing the audit of a company, another accounting firm is doing the tax work, that's also difficult. But if you definitely, when you look at the legal, the accounting, wealth management, wealth planning, all those types of things, it's a great idea for the company to get its advisors around the table at least once a year, so everybody, you know, has a check-in point and knows what the plans are for the next year, how they're all going to interact. When you get down to doing the deal, the owner's probably going to pick one of those advisors to be the lead advisor, if you will, be the captain of that team to make sure all the parts are working together. But the advisors in isolation, not a good idea.
How many accountants do you have on staff at Haskell & White now?
So we're a total of about 85 people. So if you take our support staff of about 10 out there, we've got about 75 client-facing audit and tax folks, roughly split 50-50 between our audit and tax professionals.
Excellent. I always learn a lot just spending a few minutes with you, Wayne. I really appreciate you taking the time. And I implore our listeners, visit Haskell & White's website. It's really easy, hwcpa.com. And I would imagine if someone visits and calls in and asks to speak with someone, they could get a few minutes with someone to explain their situation and see if they're a good fit.
Oh, certainly. And there's certainly ways to reach us. If you go out to the website that I appreciate you promoting, you can find drop-downs for our executive team. Our V-cards are all on there, so the numbers are out there to get us. Certainly, you can dial the general number. In Irvine, it's 949-450-6200, and our reception there can actually connect you with anybody in the Irvine or San Diego office from that same phone number.
And I know a number of the professionals over there. They are top-notch people. And, again, we go back to the value of experience, as I mentioned at the top of the show. Visit with Haskell & White and really experience that difference. Wayne, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on once again and sharing your vast knowledge with us. It's really been helpful for our listeners, and I hope we'll have a chance to talk again sometime in the near future.
My pleasure, and I would certainly welcome that. Thank you, Bill.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this, so please stay with us.
Hey, everybody, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10